We hope this explanation of God's Word enriches your life. To help you understand the audience for this talk, we suggest you read the context material on the About Us page. Please read also our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material from philipjensen.com. This talk was recorded at the lunchtime campus Bible study, where it was delivered for university students.
Thank you for continuing to put in the cards with your questions, your comments, your advice to me. I'm sorry that last week was such a sad and unhappy study, in that I didn't get any jokes from any of you. It always saddens me. Maybe it wasn't a sad and unhappy study, maybe you just were feeling sad and unhappy, but do keep rolling them in, and it's nice to see what you're saying and other illustrations of the points or disagreements. Someone asks, is university and our career part of the trivia of life, which is what we'll be dealing with today, so that'll come out of today's study, I think. Someone asked about pantheists and polytheists, saying that much of what I'm saying is addressed to the Christian and the atheist agnostic, but there's a growing number of polytheists and pantheists in our community. What does Ecclesiastes say to them? Thank you for your question. I don't know. I've never thought about it before. I do appreciate receiving questions and comments from people. It gives me a new chance. I'm sure it does have implications for the pantheist and the polytheist. I just really have never thought through the implications. And so as I read through Ecclesiastes now, I've got a new set of questions to be posing to the book to see what it actually does say or doesn't say to them. So I'm the beneficiary. And if you were looking for the answer to that today, I'm sorry, I haven't got an answer. There's a series of people asked about last time, where in chapter 3, verse 8, we read a time to love and a time to hate, a time for war and a time for peace. And quite a number of people said, how can there be a time to kill? How can there be a time to hate? How can there be a time to murder? Some say, cannot believe that God of the Bible thinks that there is a time that would be a right time for killing. If there was, then who would be to say when the right time was? And wouldn't this just be a justification for our violence, etc.? Well, let me give you six quick points on it. Big subject that comes up. Number one is to say I've got a lot of sympathy for the pacifist, the turning the other cheek. I was for about 10 years a pacifist. One could even say an active pacifist, in that I was bashed up three times during my pacifist years. Continue to be a pacifist under those circumstances, once down Hurstful Station, another time in the back street of Bondi Junction, so on. Unfortunately, when I ceased to be a pacifist, no one chose to bash me up anymore. It's always been a little sadness of life to say that I've put into practice the ideals of pacifism and I've never had a chance to put into practice the alternatives. My sympathy is still with pacifism, though, because I take it that the Bible-believing person, the godly person, actually doesn't like violence. That your natural instinct against violence and against using physical force to resolve tensions and difficulties, your instinct against it is a right instinct, that we mustn't be going in that direction. However, I found that my pacifism did not come out of my Bible believing, came out of a whole variety of other reasons, and I was forced from Bible reading to throw aside my pacifism. So the second point is that I want to point to you is that the Bible really isn't pacifist. God is called the God of the armies. That's what the word hosts mean, in case you've never understood it. He directs people to fight wars. He directs them to destroy the city of Jericho and to kill every man, woman and child in the city. That is hardly the action of a pacifist God. We've got our pacifism from elsewhere and read it into the Bible. Turn the other cheek. The slapping on the cheek's got to do with insult. Hasn't got to do with pain and violent aggression and attack. It's got to do with turning your other cheek to insult, and we've read it in. Third point is to notice that killing is not the same as murder. You see, some people say, well, how can there be a time to kill? Some say, how can there be a time to murder? As if they are the same things, and of course that's not the same thing. Murder is wrongful killing. All killing is not wrongful. As you eat your salad, so you're killing the vegetables if you haven't killed them before you start. Nothing wrong with killing vegetables. Now, you've never thought about it particularly, have you? Or killing microbes. I mean, as you drink your water, that doesn't worry you about killing. Some of you are worried about killing animals, although the Bible gives permission for that too. And the Bible also speaks of the time when it's right to kill, like it was right for the Israelites to kill the Jerichoites, or whoever they say them. And so there is a time that's right to kill, but not all killing is right. So there's a time that's wrong killing, and that's murder. Fourth point, who then determines when it's right or wrong? When is the time? If God determines it, not humans, of course. I mean, we can't say, okay, it's all right, just make up your mind whether you think it's the season for killing or not. We'll have an open season on ducks and another open season on humans. No, it's God who says when it is the right and when it is wrong, and there's very, very few times when it is right to be killing. Very rare are the times. Very unusual and extraordinary the circumstances, and they're laid down for us in God's word so that we're not given just a free range of choice of when we want to. But there is a time for doing it. And it's important to grasp that time. The illustration I used last time was that of the Second World War, when I take it, it was the right time to go to war. It was right that they postponed as long as they could. It was right to seek to bring peace with Mr. Hitler. It was right to try all the treaties that were available. But there comes a point in time when you say he can go no further, that humanity itself will not survive if this man is given free rein. And if he will not listen to reason, and he won't stick with his word, and you cannot bring any treaty into effect, you have to stop him. And there comes a time to kill. It's one of the factors that persuaded me also to review my pacifism. That is, it was easy enough for me to be a pacifist and to get bashed up. That was not a great hassle. That was, I mean, it hurt and the rest of it. But once you start taking responsibility for other people, it's a problem. It's all very well to turn my cheek, but why should I be turning the cheeks of the Sunday school class I was taking on an outing, or the youth fellowship group, or the girl I was taking out, or my children? Or how can I stand by and allow someone else to be bashed up on the grounds that I'm a pacifist? There comes a point at which direct action is the right thing to do, and not to take action is to acquiesce to brutality and murder, which must be the wrong thing to do. Fifth point to raise is we've got to remember that we're dealing here with Semitic contrast and poetry. Hebrew poetry loves putting things in parallels, and especially loves saying things in the extreme form so that you get it. Remember the words of Jesus where he says, unless a man hates his mother, brother, father, sister, wife, he cannot be my disciple. Now, Matthew's gospel translates, not like Luke, unless a man loves me more than his mother, brother, father, sister. That is how you and I would say it as English speakers, but to make the rhetorical point, the Hebrew speaker loves to put it in the extremes. You'd be silly to misunderstand Jesus. I mean, Jesus says, love your enemies. And he's now saying, hate your family. So that's what you've got to do. Hate your family and love your enemies. Now that you hate your family, they're your enemies, so you start loving them again. Now that I mean, it's absurd to take it with its logic force. You've got to take it with its poetic force. We have here in Ecclesiastes 3:1-8, a poetry. And a poetry that is particularly putting things in opposition to each other. And so we mustn't think that it's 50-50. 50% of the time you love, 50% you hate, 54, 50. It's not like that. It's trying to show up a contrast. And that brings me to the sixth point. It is the difficulty of Ecclesiastes anyway. And I remind you this last week, and I will again this week, that you must be wary of taking parts of Ecclesiastes, a verse of Ecclesiastes, and applying it willy-nilly to life. That to take verse 8 as being the motto of life is not what Ecclesiastes is saying. It's part of seeing an argument about the fact that there is a thing called a time for. And that thing called a time for indicates to you that there's more to life than just activities. There are values about life. There are judgments about life. And this sense of the timeliness of an action is the sense of having eternity in your hearts. That every time you make a moral judgment, you're actually saying there is morality in the world. Every time you make an evaluation, you're saying there are values in the world. And so you have within yourself this sense of eternity. That's the point of the argument. Now, to take one phrase of that poem and say, okay, that's the basis of Christian ethics or biblical ethics, is to misapply the scriptures badly. There are some parts of the Bible where you shouldn't be learning memory verses. The book of Job is another one, because Job's friends come and give him the wrong advice. And yet you can go and learn one of the wrong pieces of advice as a memory verse and take it as your motto for life. You see, you've got to see where the thing is in its context. And Ecclesiastes is the kind of book where you've got to look at the,
the whole line of argument, the whole drift of it, and that's why we're doing three chapters today, because it's not the verse here or the phrase there, but the whole thing. Someone raises the question of the subject of work in chapter 13 and verse 22, about whether you find the fulfilment and joy in work. And because Christian writers and others are using those verses as a vindication for careerism amongst Christianity, for finding self-fulfilment in your work and your labour. And it's, again, exactly the same mistake. It's picking a verse out of Ecclesiastes rather than looking at the drift of the argument. The drift at this point is saying, life, you can't find the meaning of life, so the best thing you can do is enjoy whatever's happening, enjoy the trivia. I mean, the best of a bad lot would be to have a job that you like doing. I mean, you're going to spend so many hours doing it, you may as well enjoy it while you go, because there's no meaning in the work you're doing. There's no end point in it. And so look at verse 22. I saw that there is nothing better for a man than to enjoy his work. Why? Well, because that's his lot. But who can bring him to see what will happen after him? You've got no idea what's it all about, so you may as well enjoy it, because if you've got to sit there at the desk for 8 hours every day, you may as well sit and enjoy what you're reading rather than sit boringly striving on with the... I won't tell you which faculty bores me. Now, come to chapter 4 to verse 6, chapters 4 and 6, and we are not going to read through it section by section this time. We're going to take it topic by topic and illustrate it from these chapters. You'll have to do the work of going back and reading it yourselves to see that I haven't misrepresented it. Always do that. Check on me. Do not believe me. Just have a look at the person beside you, would you, for a moment? Make sure that they're showing you their Bible, or if they haven't got one, that you're showing them. You got the person beside you? Hands up all those who think they're sitting next to somebody who, in this world's terms, is relatively young. Young? Anyone sitting next to young people? It's very interesting. Yeah, basically you're young, although worldwide, no, you're not. No, the average age in Asia, the average age in Africa, the average age in South America, you're pretty old, really, but not half as old as I am. Now... hands up if the person beside you think is actually fairly good looking. Hey, it's nice that there are some nice people around, even if they're willing to tell the truth. Yeah, that's right. And the person beside you is fairly healthy, aren't they? And the person beside you is fairly wealthy. I mean, we're poor students and all that kind of thing, but we're amongst friends here. There's no politicians here, so you can speak the truth. We're actually fairly wealthy. We're well off. That's the carry. On a worldwide basis, of course, we're not well off, we're filthy rich. That's the fact that we can take 3 or 4 years off work in order just to study, tremendous exercise in affluence. Now, we're very wealthy people. We're good-looking, intelligent, wealthy, young, healthy. This is called flatter the audience time. And what's more, we're all on the way up. That's the exercise we're engaged in at being at university. We're all rising, and nearly all of us are going to rise a socioeconomic notch above our parents. That's the character of people who come to universities. Not everybody, because a couple of us come from families where the parents are right at the top already and you couldn't actually go above them without dying, so it's going to be a drop for you. But for most of us, we're actually notching above our parents. That is why they have sent us and encouraged us and bedraggled us and forced us into university. We are the people who are on a career projection of achievement and success and are heading towards power and significance. You don't feel it at the moment because we're just on the bottom rung of the ladder. We're just starting out really to climb, and it's almost stationary down the bottom platform of the ladder, but that's what we are, so that as soon as you finish university, you will start earning a wage which is equal to the average wage of the Australians. I mean, faculties vary slightly up or down, but basically we will be starting at the average wage of the Australians. And from there on in, every pay rise will put us further and further up the top end of the spectrum. That is, by taking 3 years or 4 years or 6, 7, 8 years off now, depending on your faculty and your brains and hard work, taking those years off now, you bypass all the lower range of the earning capacity of the community and you start halfway in order to go to the top end. Because that is the character of graduates. We are on a projection upwards, and soon we'll acquire all the symbols of success. The cars, the clothes, the hi-fi set, the boat, the kids, the house, the overseas trip, the mortgage. That's the brilliant sign of success, that you're able to be in debt. The credit rating that goes with it, or that magnificent symbol of success, the beeper. that you carry around in your pocket on the outside so as to show everybody that you are absolutely indispensable. The world cannot exist without you being able to be in contact 24 hours a day. It, of course, is really no different to the ball and chain that they put on slaves in previous generations or on Australians when they first came out here, because it means that they've got you under their control all the time. That's really what it means. In fact, in California, they're going to put beepers on prisoners on day release now so they can keep track of them. And so they put them on professionals, junior professionals now. But it is a symbol of your importance, isn't it? Only important people walk around with beepers. I've got friends who actually walk around with them without batteries in, just to kind of show them. Now, throughout the world, though, people are not beautiful like you and I are. I thought I'd just include myself. Throughout the world, people are caught up in a whole range of different things, of poverty and of horror, of sickness, racial tensions, of fighting, of warfare, of war and famine. All over the world, you see, people are oppressed and oppressed. I think oppressed is the word I want, there's a subtle difference. They're oppressed and reduced economically and militaristically to servitude. They're still being killed in Afghanistan on this morning's news radio broadcast I listened to. There's some killed in Lebanon. It just goes on. Iraq, Iran, Ireland, South Africa, Nicaragua, Chile, China, wherever you want to go, on the right or on the left, it doesn't make much difference. All over the world, people are dying of starvation, dying of war, locked up in refugee camps without the opportunities of education, without the opportunities of 3 meals, 2 meals, even 1 meal, without the opportunities taken from their families, their homes demolished. People are in their thousands, in their millions are living like that. But statistics don't help you much because they're just numbers. We're talking about people. People who have got names. People who have got mothers and fathers and grandparents, or used to anyway. People who have got brothers and sisters. People who love and like to be loved. Who feel, who think, who enjoy, who can play games, who can experience life, who can care and be cared for. Real people. All over the world are not on the up and up like you, but are under oppression. Millions of them. Chapter 4, verse 1. Again I looked and saw all the oppression that was taking place under the sun, and I saw the tears of the oppressed, and they have no comforter. Power was on the side of their oppressors, and they have no comforter. And I declared that the dead who had already died are happier than the living who are still alive, but better than both is he who is not yet born, who has not seen the evil that is done under the sun. Ecclesiastes is not the fun time, is it? It's fairly depressing. Oppression everywhere, such that it would be better never to have been born, is what he sees and what we'll see in these next couple of chapters. Yet, still in our optimism, as the success people of the world, we have the sense that it will be better down the track. That we will make it better, that society, technology, education, democracy, or whatever it is, will solve the problems. J.F. Kennedy said, "All man's problems were created by man and can be solved by man." It's marvellous, isn't it? All our problems we created and we can solve. See the optimism, see the confidence, see the arrogance of the man who was murdered just before his brother was. Solve the problems of mankind? Can we? The United Nations, with all its different branches, UNESCO, food and the live aid concerts, spreading of all the different organisations that raise money and distribute it through the third world. Are we really getting somewhere? Chapter 5, verse 8 and 9 says, "No, oppression is endemic to the human condition. If you see the poor oppressed in a district and the justice and rights denied, do not be surprised at such things. For one official is eyed by a higher one, and over them both are others higher still. The increase from the land is taken by all. The king himself profits from the fields," which in modern English we say, taxes are inevitable. Oppression? You'll always see it. Never be surprised when you see injustice. That is exactly what you would expect to see. There are always officials, and those officials are always oppressing people, and there are always officials above them and those above them, and they're all seeking to rise up the ladder themselves, and the people they trample underneath are down, right down the bottom all the time. They're never actually there to help them. All that the work of officialdom does is to provide income for officials. I got a little strong on the subject yesterday in social workers, so if you're a social worker, just hang on for a moment here. It's not you alone, it's all the others as well. But you see, social workers really are idealistic people when they're at university, and they come into a faculty which is going to help people. But of course the tradition and effectiveness of social work is very, very questionable. And most community workers burn out and retire within the first 5 years of doing the job, because they see that in fact their idealism doesn't come into fruition, doesn't come into effect. The people who are helped by social work are social workers. They earn very good salaries. The money never reaches the poor, it reaches the aid distributor. That's where it actually reaches. Lyndon Johnson put in a huge program of the Great Society, which poured millions of dollars in, and over 4 or 5 years, millions of dollars went into the poor of America. But when they investigated the end of 4 or 5 years, they found that 80 or so percent of it arrived into the pockets of the professional workers, of the helpers, of the aiders, because their salaries are so high, that's where most of the money goes. Very little actually hits the customer. And in our profession, because the social worker is very concerned to be a profession, because if they're not a profession, they won't get professional salaries. In our profession, we're constantly eyeing how we climb the ladder of the profession, not realising that the very exercise of us climbing up is the continued maintenance of the oppression of the poor that we're supposed to be helping. You can't have a profession which is going to help the poor. It's not just the social worker department, the main roads. Same kind of thing. The engineers, here we go. It's all the same, you see. Because basically, what is the Department of Main Roads there for? It's to employ lots of people. Incidentally and accidentally, sometimes roads get built and maintained, but that's a byproduct of very small significance, because the vast majority of the money really goes into the workers in the field. It's there to keep people off the streets, or on this occasion, on the streets. But it's to feed, in fact the DMR used to be known as the Department of Many Relations. That's the character of it, that it really is a huge work, and most of it's like that. There was a marvellous Yes Minister or Yes Prime Minister, I can't remember which it was, but you know the show, if you don't, I'm sorry for you, a few years ago about a hospital which they had built, and that as the Department of Administrative Services, he being the minister for it, must have been Yes Minister, he was looking after. And in this hospital, it had been operating for some months or years, hadn't it? They had all the doctors there, the nurses, the physiotherapists, all the cleaners, all the administrators, everything there in this brilliant new building except for patients. They had no patients there. They never opened up to patients because they spent all their time and all their funds and all their resources just looking after the staff. And you see, once you've got all the doctors there, well, you've got to have all their secretaries, you've got to have all their equipment, you've got all that there, you've got to have the cleaners, you've got the cleaners and the doctor, you've got to have an accountant to look after them. And so the whole bureaucracy was set up. The whole hospital was operating without one patient for 2 or 3 years. And of course, dear Jim Hackett insisted on putting some patients in there, and that fouled up the whole system. And well, it's a good yarn. You look at Yes Minister, because he's, I know, cynical, I know overstated, I know sceptical, but it's Ecclesiastes 5, 8 and 9. It's saying that's the way the world is. That in you and I rising up the ladder, you and I forget that we are stepping down other people. Oppression is part of the game. And it always will be. There is no optimism here. But you say, well, look, the whole world may not be improved. We may not be able to pull off the JF Kennedy trick, but what about my career? Some of us can go up. I mean, the whole world may not go up, but we could climb the ladder. And of course you can believe the capitalist dream, which says that if we can push a few people far enough up, then they will kind of drag others behind them. In other words, we're not going to try and divide the cake up evenly. We're going to give some bits to really go-getters. Because if we give big bits to them, they will make a bigger cake, so that even though I get a very small slice, it'll still be a bigger slice ultimately, because the whole thing's bigger, you see, is the capital stream. If we push some people far enough up the ladder, they'll drag up other people behind them. And so I'll be one of the ones that goes up the top. Look at the motive for the toil that he says in chapter 4, verse 5. I saw that all the labour and all the achievements spring from man's envy of his neighbour. And this too is a meaningless chasing after the wind. Why do we work hard? Why do we strive? Why do we struggle? Competitiveness. That's the character of it. But remember that competitiveness is, by its very nature, antisocial. We're not going to improve society by competitiveness. Capitalism is right. It builds upon man's sinfulness. Socialism is wrong. It ignores man's sinfulness. Which is better? They're both hopeless. The motive for toil is competition. Most of you have noticed that that's how you got here. You won in a competition. Or over in chapter 5, verse 7, it's greed. Much the same. All man's effort, 5:7, all man's efforts are for his mouth, and yet his appetite is never satisfied. Verse 9, better the eye that sees than the roving appetite. See, that's the problem. Our appetites are never satisfied. We're always looking for something new, something bigger, something better. When another suit, another car, a car that's bigger and better, and the hi-fi set that got purer and more, it just never ends, does it? We never arrive. We're working so as to feed our faces, but our faces are never satisfied. Well, look at the horror of the man who's working for himself back in chapter 4, verse 8. All alone, neither son nor brother, no end to his toil, and yet his eyes weren't content with his wealth. For whom am I toiling, he asked, and why am I depriving myself of enjoyment? And this too is a meaningless, a miserable business. It's like that, though. People get involved in their careers. They get involved in their work. They go out to work just to earn money, so to put, you know, a shirt on my back and a roof over my head and food in my mouth, just to look after. But after a while, you forget that's the reason for work, and you start working for the sake of working. And you start working for the success and the achievement it gives you, and for the feeling of superiority and for the conquest you make, until in the end you're working 7 days a week, you're working 7 nights a week, you've got more money than you know what to do with, you're working so long you've got nothing to spend it on, you've got no one to share it with, but you keep working. Workaholics are very common amongst university graduates. They're not so common amongst street sweepers. It's the success people who have this problem, and they have it very acutely. Some of you may well be into it already, working for no good reason. I mean, does it really matter that you get an HD instead of a D? Most of the time it doesn't matter at all, does it? But letting go... But maybe it's not like that. Maybe you still have idealism. That I will rise to power and prominence and significance for the good of the community. To give leadership around about, for political purpose, if you like, in the nice sense of political power, where I can offer leadership within the community, that people see that I've got something that's good and it's worth offering, and they're challenging me on to do things that will be good for... Chapter 4, verse 13. Better a poor, wise youth than an old, foolish king who no longer knows how to take warning. The youth may have come from prison to the kingship, or he may have been born in poverty within his kingdom. I saw that all who lived and walked under the sun followed the youth, the king's successor. There was no end to all the people who were before them. But those who came later were not pleased with the successor. This too is a meaningless chasing after the wind. See, when you're young and wise and you're on the up and up, everyone's for you. Much better you than the king who is old and foolish and now ruling. And so they will make you king. And you know what you'll be then, don't you? The old and foolish king that's ruling. And some young whippersnapper's going to rise up and they'll all be after him and pushing and promoting him too. Whose successor will you have? See, it's better to be young and teachable than old and foolish. But if you really are young and wise and teachable, all you do is become old and foolish. When you rise to power, no one will want you. All kings, all politicians are popular for a while, and they all go off. I remember those giddy and incredible night in which Gough Whitlam was elected to power. The sheer excitement, the sheer pleasure. What's his name, Macaris, nearly blew a blood vessel right in front of the television set as he told all the landslide of the... The whole world was changing. And the joy and the shouts and the cheer. And 3 years later, it was exactly the same when they kicked him out of office. And welcome Malcolm Fraser as the saviour of mankind, or at least Australia. For 5 or 7 years until they kicked him out of office. And then we have Bob and Hazel. They're going to solve all our problems. And how long will you think they'll stay in office? It's always the same. Nick Grainer might be at the moment enjoying the honeymoon, but he better enjoy it while he's got it, because within a little while, you'll see that he'll be loved about as much as Barry Unsworth. It's always the same. You think that you really are going to be any better, think again, friends. It's never like that. The poor are always oppressed. Changes in government do not improve the poor. They just raise taxes. Politicians, civil servants always line their own pocket, always grow in their own wealth and leave the poor poor. That's the character of them. Do you think there are no poor in Russia? There are no poor in China? Do you think there are no poor in Chile? Do you think there's no... I mean, which end of the spectrum you want to go to, which revolution you're talking about, makes no difference. The poor remain poor and the rich remain rich. And the politicians have their pensions, their superannuation, their cars, their drivers, their gold passes to this and that, their government house with swimming pool, gym and squash courts, and of course the most essential part of any government house in Australia, their members' bar. Do you notice that incredible play out for the South Australian shearer who represented the Port of Adelaide for some years in Parliament? There was a real working class man representing working class men. And at the end of his time in Parliament, he left with incredible wealth and opportunities for even greater wealth in his retirement and his superannuation payout and all the lurks and perks in office. But the poor in Adelaide are still poor. They're exactly the same. There's only one man who's become rich out of that whole exercise. It's always the same. So you say, well, let's face it then. We're not going to make society better. Let's at least make our bit of it. I mean, do away with the idealism. Let's face the realities of wealth. Let's see what we're really here for, to grow in our own wealth. Let's see what value I can acquire in my money. Because after all, that's what university's about. I mean, you may not yet face it because you still have the wetness behind the ears that believes that you're here for idealistic purposes, but you're not. You're here so as to grow wealth for the family, especially you and your family. That's what it's about. I mean, I always laugh when I meet socialists at university. Because the idealism is a nonsense, it's a contradiction of terms to be a socialist at a university. The whole purpose of being at university is to be a career person, that is to be a capitalist. And therefore to come to university and be a socialist is just a contradiction in terms. It's a nonsense. If you really believed in socialism, then you wouldn't be at university. That's a silly place to be. Or you might be at a place of learning, but you wouldn't be at a place of career building. And a long time since university has been a place of learning. It's career building, that's what it's about. In fact, we don't have learning day, we have careers day, don't we? Because we know what we're about now. We're training people. The whole purpose of being at university is to be a career person, that is to be a capitalist. And therefore to come to university and be a socialist is just a contradiction in terms. It's a nonsense. If you really believed in socialism, then you wouldn't be at university. That's a silly place to be. Or you might be at a place of learning, but you wouldn't be at a place of career building. And a long time since university has been a place of learning. It's career building. That's what it's about. In fact, we don't have learning day. We have careers day, don't we? Because we know what we're about now. We're training people for professional careers. That is big bucks for success, for power, for status. How can you be a dyed-in-the-wool socialist and be at university? Terrible contradiction in terms. That's not to say you shouldn't be a socialist. It's not to say you shouldn't be at university. I'm just saying there's a contradiction there. So let's be honest and say I'm here for the bucks. I'm in the commerce faculty. I know what I'm about. It's got nothing to do with learning. I love the commerce faculty. It's the one honest faculty in the whole campus. Right? I've never had a commerce student rationalise to me that they're here for intellectual endeavour and inquiring minds. Nothing, you can't do it, can you? I mean, you're here for one reason, aren't you? Money. And it's honest, unlike some other faculties who pretend they're here for other reasons. I've never heard anyone rationalise why they're here for ceramic engineering. Now, taking the honesty of wealth, what about my career, my money, my values, the thing that says at the end of life, it was worth doing, look at all the money I've made. Chapter 5, verse 10. Whoever loves money never has money enough. Whoever loves wealth is never satisfied with his income. That too is meaningless. That's a problem, isn't it? When you're a kid and your father gives you 40 cents for pocket money, at the end of the week you have 2 cents over. A few years later when he's giving you $4, you still only have 2 cents over. When you're at uni and you're getting $40, you still only have 2 cents. When you're out at work and you get $400, you still only have 2 cents over. Your money never satisfies. That's the character of money. It's always the same. You always want more. You see, wealthy people embezzling money from other people, gambling for money. It's incredible to go down there at Randwick Racecourse and see fabulously wealthy people, judging by all the clothes they're wearing, the cars they're driving, etc., gambling money to make more money. Having lots of money won't solve your problem. In fact, it creates other problems. Look at verse 11. As goods increase, so do those who consume them. And what benefit are they to the owner except to feast their eyes on them? See, the more money you get, the more hanger-oners you'll have around about you. Don't you feel sorry for those pathetic boxers, professional boxers? If they're any good at it, getting their heads bashed in and their brains knocked around, if they're any good at it, they acquire more and more hanger-oners. Publicity officers, photographers, chauffeurs, cleaners, physiotherapists, the professionals have to get in, physiotherapists, their own medical advisors. They get more and more people hanging around so that in the end, when they've finally had their brains bashed to a pulp so they won't notice, everybody else has made money out of them except them. Now they live in poverty, sweeping out pubs somewhere. The story of professional boxing is a story of total and degradation. None of them actually make anything out of it, except punch drunkenness. But it's the same with the pop singers. I've had any number of friends who have gone into the rock business, made big bucks, but in fact, they never make big bucks, because if they're any good, they've got to have so much equipment and so many people to look after the equipment. They've got to tour so much. They've got to have so much tour managers. They've got everybody else is making money, but the pop singer in the end looks around and it's just loads and loads of hanger-oners. One of the pop singers came out here last year with a retinue of over 50 people to look after him in his tour. It hasn't read Ecclesiastes 5:11 or 12. The sleep of this labourer is sweet, whether he eats little or much, but the abundance of the rich man permits him no sleep. I'm not quite sure whether that's anxiety that permits him no sleep or indigestion. But either way, it's the rich man who has the problem going to sleep at night. Not the poor man who's done an honest day's work. You think you're going to grow and it's unsatisfying, your wealth. You may not recognise it yet because you're only looking at it from the bottom rung up, but look at the top rung and see what they're really like. And furthermore, it's all transient. You gather and you have every chance of losing it. You gather it and you die and you leave it to somebody else. You gather and how can you keep it in a way that will not dissipate? There are no such things as securities. Don't let any economist tell you there are. Securities are a total misnomer. There's only insecurities in the financial world. There's no securities. Why, people tell us you can't have a Wall Street crash again. At least they used to say it before last year. I have seen a grievous evil under the sun, 5:13, and the wealth hoarded to the harm of its owner. Wealth lost through some misfortune, so that when he has a son, there is nothing left for him. The thief comes in at night, the inflation takes it away, you just can't win on it. Naked a man comes from the womb, from his mother's womb, and as he comes, so he departs. He takes nothing for his labour that he can carry with his hand. You see, it's not only wealth is transient, we are transient as well. And the amount of money we carried into this world is the amount of money we're going to carry out of it, because in a shroud, there are no pockets. And so what value is there in this world but to enjoy ourselves? But gathering wealth doesn't necessarily mean we gather enjoyment. This is this dreadfully sad bit down in chapter 6, as if the other's not sad enough. Chapter 6, 1. I have seen another evil under the sun, and it weighs heavily on men. God gives a man wealth, possessions, honour, so that he lacks nothing his heart desires, but God doesn't enable him to enjoy them. And a stranger enjoys them instead. This too is meaningless, a grievous evil. A man may have 100 children and live many, many years, yet no matter how long he lives, if he cannot enjoy his prosperity, doesn't receive a proper burial, I say that a stillborn child is better off than he. It, that's the stillborn child, comes without meaning, departs in darkness, and in darkness its name is shrouded. Though it never saw the sun or knew anything, it had more rest than does that man. Even if he lives 1,000 years twice over but fails to enjoy his prosperity, do not all go to the same place? There's the problem, you see. There's no enjoyment in it. In fact, you often can't enjoy it because by the time you've arrived at the top, your capacity for enjoyment is gone. You're too sick, you're too old, you're too dead, you're too worried to actually enjoy what it is. You keep postponing your enjoyment, your superannuation, till your retirement, but in your retirement, you're too sick. You're too weary, you're too worn to actually enjoy it anymore. The best years for enjoyment are these ones, friends, that you're in at the moment, but you're too busy passing exams to enjoy them. But you say, but by doing this, I'll be able to have more money in the future for bigger enjoyment. You keep postponing, you'll never get to the enjoyment stage.
My father-in-law, in his retirement, travelled the world on the Women's Weekly World Tour thing on the boat. And he said he was one of the very few men there because most of them were widows. Most of the people were widows whose husband had died in the first 12 months of retirement. If that wasn't bad enough, that they'd lived their life working their guts out to save up for the great trip, to die knowing that your widow was going to take it with you, with her, would be even a more bitter pill for many a man. That's the character of life for people. Old people don't enjoy much. Have you been to an old age home lately? You should do it every year, at least once a year, just to get a perspective on life. Walk around a geriatric unit. Walk around and see what... The people will love to see you there because they're lying waiting for people to come and talk to them, and nobody ever does. They'll love it, but you'll learn. You'll learn what you will be like in 30, 40, 50 years' time. You'll learn how unenjoyable it is to be old. You'll learn how useless it is to gather up your wealth for the future day of happiness. It doesn't happen, friends. Our society is wealthy and worried and anxious. It's the character of it. We are a society of people who are massively overweight, sitting on top of an exercise bike, cycling furiously and getting nowhere. And so some people, some non-Christians have seen the way forward is downward mobility, not upward mobility. Drop out, give up, throw it away. No longer pursue the growth equaling progress, the power, the status, the significance, the give it away, drop out. Brown rice, brown sugar, insecticide, free fruit, biodynamic, etc. Now our author has no sentiment. Chapter 4, verse 5, the fool folds his hands and ruins himself. It's a foolishness to drop out like that. It ends in terrible ruin. You see, people who live and eat and sleep and die on the streets of Calcutta, they don't go off to Nimbin. They don't go off to some countercultural community to live. Only people who can afford to go to Nimbin are the filthy rich. They're the only ones who can afford such a luxury of life to drop out. It's an absurdity of middle-class, over-wealthy Australians to go dropping out and living off the land. In fact, the survey done by Mr. Hawke's department, because his children had dropped out and told him the wonders of the world, the survey done by them found out it cost Australians more to keep people in those Nimbin communes than if they gave them the dole and they stayed in Sydney doing nothing. It's a very expensive enterprise to drop out. It's a foolishness. And so he dismisses materialism and anti-materialism. Look at verse 6. Better one hand with tranquility than two handfuls with toil and a chasing after the wind. And he comes to this method of argument that I call comparisons. He's got no absolutes under the sun, but there are relatives. That is, this is better than that. This is better than that. This thing is better than that. So I could follow out what's the better rather than the worse. And one thing that's better is one hand is one hand's work and tranquility than two hands' work and no tranquility. It's better to have a balance between some work and some rest than just flat out work or flat out rest. A bit of both is better. Students, take notice of that, please. Because some of you go for the laying back and do nothing for a year and then work next year, and some of you go for working flat out. Better to live it in balance, he says. The balance of moderation. That's the character of, don't go down the workaholic. No, the pursuit of mediocrity, not the pursuit of excellence, is the better way of living. Or he says it's better to have society in verses 9 following of chapter 4. Better two than one, because they have a good return for their work. If one falls down, his friend can pick him up. But pity the man who falls, and he has no one to help him. If two lie down together, they will keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone, etc.? Right? It's better to live in relationship with other people than out there by yourself. That's a better. Or he says, better the poverty and wisdom of the young man on the way up than the foolishness and the power and the man who is on the top in chapter 4, 13 following, which we read earlier. But his real thump comes in chapter 5. Here's a better. 5:1. Guard your steps when you go to the house of God. Go near to listen rather than to offer the sacrifice of fools who do not know they do wrong. Do not be quick with your mouth. Do not be hasty in your heart to utter anything before God. God is in heaven. You are on earth, so let your words be few. Down verse 7, much dreaming, many words are meaningless. Therefore stand in awe of God. better to shut up and listen to God than to be always talking, always arguing, always telling, directing, complaining, testing God. Instead, if God is God, then we must listen to God. And so are there answers he has here in the whole chasing of this world for power and status and significance and wealth and the rest? He says, yes, a lot of life is just enjoyable trivia. It's meaningless whether you work and joy, so just do the best you can under the circumstances. It's all just... But if you stop to think about it, it's unenjoyable. If you actually put your mind to it, you'll have to read that passage yourself. You'll find that it's endless and it's stupid, and thinking about it's even endless and stupid. And so he has this series of comparisons, better this than that, by which he can hope to find some truth. But the one he comes to most firmly is better to listen to God than to be babbling, offering the sacrifices of the fools. Talk, 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 when you don't know what you're talking about. If in this world we are placed in ignorance so that we do not know what the life is about, if we're placed in a world of meaningless where we can't find any meaning, then why write books about it? That's one of the funny things about existentialists. They keep on writing books meaningfully expounding the theory of meaninglessness. If it's really meaningless, give up writing the books. If it really is futile, shut up. I mean, what's the point? What's the point of Mr. Skinner, who says everything is a result of your conditioning, writing a book like Waldon 2, which is a utopia where he's encouraging us to set up a new world and a new society all based on conditioning? I mean, if you've been conditioned, you'll believe him. If you haven't been conditioned his way, you won't believe him. But either way, it's stupid writing a book asking you to think it, because the thinking is just an expression of conditioning. It's all meaningless. It's all purposeless. But he keeps writing books about it. If life is as meaningless as you think it is, then shut up. Maybe if you shut up, you might start listening. And if you start listening, you might hear God. And when you listen to God, you will hear that all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge are found in the person of Jesus Christ. It's the fear of the Lord, it is 5:7, standing in awe of God, which is the beginning of wisdom. Let's pray. We thank you, Father, for your Son revealing himself to us. We pray for our hearts, Father, that you would help us in the meaninglessness of life, in the ignorance we have of and the hopelessness of finding any meaning to these things, that you'd help us to stop and listen to what you have to say, that we can hear from you and stand in awe of you and come to understand what you have in the meaning of our lives. And we ask it in Jesus' name. Amen.
Thank you for listening to the talks on philipjensen.com. Please check our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material on philipjensen.com.